At Verizon, anyone can trade in their old phone for a new one on us with Unlimited Ultimate, which means everyone in your family could get a new phone and stay on your family plan, keeping you close.
Hey, Mom, you seen my toothbrush?
Yeah, I'm almost done with it.
Oh, maybe too close. Trade-in and additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to the first edition of the Three Down Nation podcast in 2025. Boys, got any New Year's resolutions?
I don't really believe in New Year's resolutions, personally. I think that if you're going to change something about your life, waiting arbitrarily until January 1st doesn't make a lot of sense. You should just do it now. So I don't. But do I have goals? Yeah, of course I do.
That's an interesting way to look at it, Hodge. I do think it's nice to have like a trigger that makes you think about ways to improve yourself. I'll say, professionally, my goal this year is to be faster with the fingers. Typing. That's my goal.
You can do it. I believe in you, kid.
Hey, going from 10 words per minute to 12, I think is absolutely a goal that you could achieve. Absolutely. I believe in you, JC.
Boys, the quote that has always resonated with me, and Hodge, to your point, I don't think if you're out there, you know, thinking about a New Year's resolution that you need January 1st to make change in your life, go ahead and do it. But nothing changes if nothing changes. If you want to reach new heights, like we're pushing all the time to do, I believe, at least the three of us at 3downnation.com and our contributors as well, get out there. Perhaps you might be a little nervous about it, but you might surprise yourself with what you can accomplish in 2025. I'm, of course, Justin Dunk, joined by John Hodge and JC Abbott. Let's get to that professional Canadian football talk. Today, we're discussing Mekhi Polk becoming the first CFL player to sign an NFL contract this offseason.
Bo Levi Mitchell receiving his first offseason roster bonus from the Hamilton Tiger Cats.
BC unveiling its new coaching staff.
Three Down Nation's somewhat controversial all-time CFL logo rankings.
G. Roy Simon reportedly departing the CFL for a job in the NCAA.
And whether the CFL should limit the number of punts in games. But first,
the BC Lions and Toronto Argonauts made a big trade as Dijon Allen, a two-time all-CFL offensive lineman, was sent to the West Coast in exchange for Canadian rising linebacker Ryder Varga and a second round pick in the 2026 CFL draft. Which team won the deal?
First of all, I just want to say a huge thank you to BC and Toronto for executing a big trade on a random Monday in January. As people who cover the CFL and rely on news, this was, I think, Three Down Nation won this trade because we got a big piece of news to report. So thank you, Ryan Rigmaiden. Thank you, John Murphy, and all involved with making this deal. But on a more serious note, when this trade was first announced, my original feeling was Toronto won the trade. Because at the end of the day, garnering Canadian assets back for an American asset in the CFL is generally very good business. Ryder Varga is a heck of a player. To me, he is a true starter at weak side linebacker. And the Argonauts, whether it's Fraser Sopik, whether it's Jack Kassar, like they have a good group of Canadian linebackers that they've kind of rotated in and have started here and there. And I think that Varga is a great player. And then you get the 2026 second round pick, which obviously, depending on where BC finishes in the standings, could even be a top 10 pick, or at least a top, 15 pick. That being said, as time has gone on, I've come a little bit more onto the fence here. Dijon Allen, I don't think, I think he's a very good player. I'm not sure he is the best right tackle in the CFL, but this is a team that loves to pass the ball, or at least it certainly did this past season. I would imagine that will continue with their new coaching staff, with Nathan Rourke still under center. And it was in the press release, Ryan Rigmaid and the club's new GM saying, our offensive line needed to get better. Well, according to PFF, Dejon Allen is the best pass blocker in the CFL. So if you are going to protect Nathan Rourke when he drops back to pass 30, 35, 40 times a game, he is a good asset. And when you look at the CFL landscape, the position at which it is, and this will come up when you're talking to talent evaluators, offensive tackle might be the toughest position to recruit right now. We saw Jermarcus Hardrick sign an unbelievably big deal in free agency last year with the Saskatchewan Roughriders. And if you're the BC Lions and you want to upgrade that tackle spot, I think this is just the price you have to pay. It's a very good young Canadian player and a not a first round pick, but still a high pick. So I do like this trade for both teams, but I do think it was a steep price for the Lions to pay, albeit apparently the market rate.
I think value wise, both of these teams got about equivalent in return. But the team that improved more as a result of making this trade was undoubtedly the BC Lions. Because the Toronto Argonauts, yes, they maybe get a little bit better at that weak side linebacker spot. I love Fraser Sobick, but I think Ryder Varga, as he matures into that role, will be a bit of an upgrade going forward. But in terms of importance to the team, importance to what the team needs, it's not as big of a deal as adding a premier right tackle to protect your franchise quarterback. And that's what the BC Lions have done, dealing from a position of strength to one of weakness, where they have not been very good along the offensive line for the last number of years, particularly last season. But they have had a lot of Canadian depth at linebacker. They still have Ben Hladik there. They can re-sign Bola Combo if they really want. But they also have a bunch of young Americans, Ace Ely and Josh Woods, who are under contract for next season and very exciting young prospects who they want to see have more time. So they're not necessarily in a position where they want to start two Canadian linebackers there. They do want to upgrade that tackle position and make sure that Rourke has the time he needs to flourish in the pocket, go through his reads, and pick apart defenses. Dejon Allen is going to make that happen. And as a result, I think this was a tremendous deal for BC.
The winner of this trade, fellas? Come on, you know what my answer is going to be. Guess.
Three Down Nation?
Nathan Rourke.
Indeed, JC. Ding, 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 ding. It is the Canadian quarterback, Nathan Rourke, because hopefully this can help him be protected and get back to somewhere close to his 2022 form that he showed. And I love the way that JC put it. The Lions deal from a position of strength to upgrade in an area of weakness. Smart move by Ryan Rigmaiden. And, you know, I've thought about this over the years covering the league, that you hear these coaches and personnel people talk about what they're going to do, but actions, in many cases, speak louder than words. And the fact that Rigmaiden, not too long on the job as the GM of the BC Lions, has gone out and acquired a legit starter at the tackle position to help out the offensive line, his new offensive-minded head coach in Buck Pierce, and Nathan Rourke, who's the highest-paid player in the league by a country mile, is him putting those words into action. So I think this trade ultimately benefits Nathan Rourke the most.
Kent Perkins has been the right tackle in BC for a number of years. He is a pending free agent. I would assume that this trade is kind of the way he found out he will not be back for next season. which, you know, if I'm Kent Perkins' agent, I'm probably asking for his release right now so we can get a bit of a head start on the free agent market. I do think that Perkins is a player who would be of interest to teams around the league. At the end of the day, I don't think BC's interior has been good enough the last couple of years. If Ryan Rigmaiden is this aggressive, and I do respect the aggressiveness 100%, in upgrading the tackle spot, I'm very excited to see what he will do with the interior of that offensive line. There are a number of players on that O-line who are up for new contracts. So there is an opportunity here in front of Nathan Rourke to build that. And this is a team that the last few years that has spent a lot of money on that receiving core. There's always that debate, right? Where do you spend your money? Is it the offensive line? Is it the running back position where William Standback arguably is due for a increase in pay? At least in the short term, Dejon Allen, $210,000 in hard money in 2025. Apparently, that is the first place that BC has looked to spend their coin.
And it should be noted that Toronto Argonauts don't exactly put themselves in a bad position along the offensive line with this move, despite the fact that they're losing an extremely talented player, a guy who just, I guess, a season ago, or is it two seasons ago now, was most outstanding offensive lineman in the entire CFL. But we saw what happened last year. They could re-sign Isaiah Cage, who has typically played left tackle. But when he went down last season, Ryan Hunter bumped out there and looked basically seamless at tackle for the end of the season and the playoffs. One most outstanding offensive lineman himself. He could very easily play the same role on the right side. And let's not forget that they just brought in a guy named Sage Dockstigger in the pipeline, a Canadian tackle that they've waited a long time to get their hands on. I'm sure they're trying to position him for a bigger role going forward, not necessarily immediately starting next year, but potentially down the line with a prospect of that magnitude. They have the pieces in place to potentially start a Canadian at one of those two tackle spots, and that makes this loss a little bit less of a sting and certainly a financial boon for them at other positions.
Just don't watch some of that tape between Willie Jefferson and Ryan Hunter from the Grey Cup, and you'll be okay with him at tackle. I do think he can be pretty good at tackle. And to Hodge's point, I think the Argonauts have shown in this deal too, I think it should be said, they're dealing from a position of strength in my mind, because I think we would all agree that the Argos have had the best offensive line in the CFL for the last couple of seasons. Yay or nay?
Yay. Yeah, I think so. I'd say yes.
So then that's probably where you should be investing your money. And I think the Argos have shown that you can invest your money there into the quarterback. And you obviously want to have talented skill position players around you, but also that they'll go out and find players like a Mekhi Polk, who we'll talk about a little later, to fill in there when your quarterback has a good amount of time in the pocket and is a capable trigger man, as Chad Kelly is as a football player. And then you can plug in a Kadeem Carey, where you don't have to pay a crazy amount in CFL terms for a running back who can get you 1,000 yards behind that big, strong, tough, physical offensive line that can pass block at a high level as well. I think that's a great point that both of you have now made, that Ryan Rigmaiden needs to improve the interior on that BC Lions offensive line. I know William Standback's going to want a raise, but I think the Lions would be better off investing in the offensive line. And Rigmaiden, correct me if I'm wrong, JC, has already kind of alluded to the fact that they're going to have to go young at some of these other positions, you know, especially American receiver.
Yeah, he has made that indication, and that's part of the reason why, as a GM, unconventionally, he's going to spend a lot of his time on the road. He's going to be in Vancouver for about 6 months of the year, and the rest of the time, he's going to continue essentially his regular scouting work, moving around the United States, visiting colleges, looking for prospects, which he's done at such a high level in the past, because he knows with the money that they're paying guys like Rourke, Matthew Betts, and now, of course, Dejon Allen, they're going to have to go cheap at other positions. You can succeed that way if you find the right prospects, as the Argonauts have shown in the past. BC has to have that formula. The Saskatchewan Roughriders traded a conditional 8th-round CFL draft pick to the Calgary Stampeders in exchange for the rights to quarterback Jake Mayer. The 27-year-old remains a pending free agent, and the Riders have until February 11th to negotiate a new deal with him. Could Mayer be the heir apparent to Trevor Harris?
I believe so, and I don't understand people out there talking about these potential paper transactions, like Cody Fajardo going to the Edmonton Elks. He's already reworked his contract, excuse me, okay? Jake Mayer, I believe, is going to sign with the Riders, because if you're Mayer and you look around, you think, hey, I know Mark Mueller, I have an idea of his offense. We've been together in Calgary, and you can see, and Trevor Harris has been open and talking about this, that yes, his age is getting up there, but he's year to year in terms of playing football himself. So there's a pathway to Mayer potentially being QB1 in Saskatchewan. And some people might laugh and snicker at that, but I actually think there's some legitimacy to it. Mayer hasn't been in the greatest of situations the last couple of years with the Calgary Stampeders. I know in 2023, I'm going to get my years mixed up here now that we're in 2025, but in 2023, the Stamps went to the playoffs, lost at BC Place in the West semifinal. But just the way that some things have transpired with that team, I don't think necessarily set him up for success. And I think it could be beneficial for him to be in a new place and sort of go through a year where he's not the guy and learn it from a different perspective with Trevor Harris and Mark Mueller, who really believes in him. You can do great things with people around you who actually believe in you. And I'm not saying Calgary didn't, but it seemed like as the season got away from the Stampeders in 2024, that the narrative out there was that they had to make a change at the quarterback position. And that's essentially what has happened. So if you get brought into Saskatchewan, learn from Mark Mueller, who is already on the radar as a head coach around the Canadian Football League, that he could be the heir apparent in Saskatchewan, or perhaps he's groomed to be Mueller's quarterback if, and I probably should say when, he becomes a head coach in the CFL someday.
I couldn't agree more. Jake Mayer is 27 years old, right? Trevor Harris, the guy he's behind, became a CFL starter, I believe it was at the age of 29. Like, Trevor Harris waited a long time for that first shot. And there are parts of Jake Mayer's game I don't love. I think he is probably the least mobile quarterback in the CFL, and that includes some people who are 10 years older than him. That being said, he's a guy who had immediate success in this league and then kind of saw that taper off a little bit down the line. He would not be the first quarterback who had flashes early on and then was able to find that again later in his career, or had some bumps in the road year two, year three, and then succeed. Something I do love about Jake Mayer is he is healthy as a horse. Like, this man will never miss games due to injury, apparently. I don't want to jinx him, but that is something that Trevor Harris traditionally was, and that stopped when he got to Saskatchewan, right? The last 2 years, Trevor Harris has missed half of Saskatchewan's games, and that has not boded well for the Saskatchewan Roughriders. So I think that Jake Mayer is a good fit with the familiarity he has with the coaching staff. I think he is a good fit from a stylistic standpoint. I think Trevor Harris is a little bit more athletic, but at the end of the day, he is a true pocket passer by CFL standards, at the least. And I do think he is a great fit from a health standpoint. The Saskatchewan Roughriders, if Trevor Harris gets hurt, need someone who can put two hands on the wheel and drive the boat. And if there's somebody who you can trust to do that, it is Jake Mayer. He is healthy. He is ready to go. He is a veteran at this point, and I think that this is a great opportunity for Saskatchewan to upgrade their backup spot, because for all that we love to rag on JC on this podcast, I do think that his off-season take of Shea Patterson not being good enough to be the primary backup in Saskatchewan aged well. I don't think that Shea Patterson was a disaster in Saskatchewan by any point, but there was a significant drop off from Trevor Harris to Shea Patterson. And I think that Jake Mayer is a considerable upgrade for the Riders at that spot.
And if you're Jake Mayer, if I can speak directly to you, Jake, grab the pen right now and sign the contract, right? Whatever renegotiated deal, I don't know what the offers will be. You're not going to find a better spot in the CFL right now than Saskatchewan. There's basically a guarantee that you're going to see some game action this year based on the recent past with Trevor Harris and the fact that he has battled some injuries. And then with Harris being 38 years old, you are positioning yourself as well as you could possibly position yourself in any city to be the guy in a year or two. This is a great spot for Jake Mayer to be. And frankly, I think it was a great move from the Saskatchewan Roughriders to work on that reclamation project, because there are still pieces. We've seen guys develop later in their career at stop. number two or stop number three into legitimate top tier CFL starters. We've even seen it with Trevor Harris as his career went on, improving and becoming a better quarterback. I think this is a great move for everybody.
There's a couple things that come to mind here for me, guys. First of all, for Trevor Harris, we're kind of putting this injury label on him, but at least these injuries haven't been non-contact. Like, his body, I think, can still hold up. It's just some unfortunate situations where he's essentially gotten fallen on a couple times have led to the one major injury and then the one with his knee that kept him out for six games in 2024. And if you look at Jake Baer, guys, over the last two seasons, he's averaged over 4,000 passing yards per season. Who else has done that in the CFL? That jumps right to your mind. Like, it's not like this guy has been terrible. And there have been games where, you know, I can remember watching live in Toronto, he absolutely lit up the Argonauts in their secondary. And with the deep precision that he can have at times, and yes, it kind of is hot and cold, but if you put him in this receiving core, if he does have to play, as you guys alluded to, in 2025, you know, I think there is a lot of upside there. And I don't think he can just drive the boat. I think there's potential for him in the future to take it to another level. And Hodge, you mentioned this earlier with the way that Kent Perkins was finding out that he probably wasn't going to be back in BC. Well, the same could be said for Shea Patterson. He finds this out. So, you know, sometimes this makes me wonder what happens behind the scenes. Getting to know Corey Mace a little bit through his first season in Saskatchewan, I would imagine, I don't usually like to do this, but that he would have reached out to Patterson and let him know about this trade and their intention to sign Jake Mayer. Because the other piece to this is that the Riders are really high on Jack Cohen. So is Trevor Harris. Trevor Harris has talked about him in a very complimentary way, and honestly, a way that told me that the Riders could have potentially favored Jack Cohn over Shea Patterson for the backup spot if they didn't do anything else at the quarterback position. He talked about Jack Cohn being in the film room with him early, and I don't want to put words in his mouth, but the same compliments did not come in terms of Shea Patterson. So I'm very curious to see how the quarterback situation plays out in the future. It's always a topic of debate, and some people will tell you in Saskatchewan that the favorite person in the province can be the backup quarterback. But if you're Jake Mayer, you also have to be ready for that smoke. Trevor Harris deals with it extremely professionally and well, but it is something, especially with Mayer going from Calgary to Saskatchewan, if he does indeed put pen to paper, which I believe he will, that he's going to have to get used to. It's on a completely different level.
And just one minor note. He is a pending free agent. So technically, there's no deal to renegotiate. It is a fresh deal, but I agree. I think there's a very good chance he will re-sign in Saskatchewan. I think it's the best place for him. And he's certainly not going to have that familiarity with any other coaching staff. The only other place where that might happen is Toronto, where he has some experience with Ryan Dinwiddie. That being said, I think Toronto, with the Grey Cup hero, Nick Arbuckle, now being, you know, a Grey Cup MVP, I think, you know, he's pretty well suited to be the backup there. The BC Lions unveiled their coaching staff with new head coach Buck Pierce, bringing receivers coach Kevin Burgoyne over from the Winnipeg Blue Bombers. Mike Benavides moving from special teams coordinator to defensive coordinator, and Ryan Phillips being demoted from defensive coordinator to defensive backs coach. What do you make of the unit overall?
I want to preface this by saying that I think there's a number of extremely qualified and quality coaches that have been brought onto this BC Lions staff. Guys who have been around the CFL for a number of years, who have had success at multiple stops. So this isn't a bad staff by any stretch of the imagination. But I think when you compare it to the other new staff that is being assembled in the CFL right now, what's going on in Edmonton, it's hard not to look at this group and be, perhaps the term is underwhelmed, right? When we heard a lot of the announcements or reports of who was going to be in Edmonton, Jordan Maksimek going over there under Mark Killam, JC Sherritt making the jump as defensive coordinator. We saw those moves and we go, wow, that's a really exciting young staff. Those are guys that people feel really highly about. And when you look at the BC Lions, there's a lot more experience, which is good for Buck Pierce as a first-time head coach, but there's not necessarily the same level of names that people are excited about for the future. Now, that does not mean that this isn't going to be a staff that has success, but when you're moving Mike Benavides from special teams coordinator to defensive coordinator, a guy who used to be the head coach in BC and was fired, as much as I like Mike Benavides both as a person and as a coach and believes he deserves these opportunities, it's not going to fire up your fan base in the way that some other new hires would. And frankly, I think there is some disconnect as well in terms of moves like Ryan Phillips being demoted, because yes, the Lions struggled last year, but I think that was a personnel issue, not a coaching issue. And Ryan Phillips in the two previous seasons had shown himself to be one of the most exciting young DCs in the Canadian Football League. It didn't feel like he needed to be demoted. And now, as a guy who's still under his defensive coordinator contract and is now serving underneath somebody else as a position coach, this seems like it might be a little bit of an awkward fit out here in Vancouver in terms of those dynamics. Even though I'm sure Mike and Ryan get along really well, having worked on the staff previously, there's a power shift there that is going to be awkward for some of the players and for those coaches as they feel this out. So there's some positive things here. I like Kevin Burgoyne. I like the experience for Buck Pierce, but I was underwhelmed with the staff overall.
I'm really intrigued to see and try to understand if Kevin Burgoyne is going to be more involved than just simply being the receivers coach. I'd expect that to be the case, especially with the relationship he has with Buck Pierce and their time together in Winnipeg. And you know what this offense can do, that will tell a lot to me about the potential excitement of this staff. I do think, JC, that your points are valid about the potential awkwardness among the players with Ryan Phillips being demoted and then Mike Benavides moving from special teams to defensive coordinator. I'm not saying he can't get it done, and BC fans might actually get excited, because when you look at Benavides and his head coaching record, it's really good. It's better than a lot of the head coaches, you know, out there or who have come through the league. I think it's 33-21 overall. Mm-hmm. But there's no doubt that that is a weird situation with the players who are going, you know, Ryan Phillips was my defensive coordinator. Now he's demoted, still on the staff, special teams coordinator is the DC. But BC has told us, Buck Pierce, Ryan Rigmaiden, Dwayne Vienno, and Amar Doman, that this is what they believe is the best staff for 2025. So let's see how it rides, but I'm most intrigued to see how the offense goes with Buck Pierce and Kevin Burgoyne.
Yeah, didn't Buck Pierce, during his introductory press conference, say he wasn't going to be his own OC?
No, he said he was going to be.
He said he was going to be. Okay, yeah. Thank you for that. I misremembered that. Something that was interesting is on the press release, it indicated that Kevin Burgoyne was the receivers coach and Ryan Phillips was the DB coach and passing game coordinator, which is kind of a weird combination. Subsequently, looking at the team's website, they have Burgoyne listed as the wide receivers coach and passing game coordinator, and Ryan Phillips is listed as the secondary coach and passing game coordinator. So either that's a logistical error, or they have two
passing game
coordinators.
Defense and offense.
Okay, fair enough.
That's like Josh Bell in Saskatchewan. He was a DB coach and the pass game coordinator from a defensive perspective.
So defensively, he is coaching against the pass.
Or Will Fields in Toronto versus Kevin Iben when they were co-defensive coordinators. One was more of a coverage guy. One was a front seven guy.
Okay, so maybe the I would love to talk to people if they had some type of truth serum in BC to understand what is really the role here. Like, is Kevin Burgoyne only the passing game coordinator offensively, we'll call it, because they needed to give him a title increase to get him out of Winnipeg? Or is he like the de facto OC and Buck is just going to kind of rubber stamp things? Like, I'm very interested to see what the working relationship will be there. It's possible that they don't even know. But I did expect Kevin Burgoyne to be a serious candidate to become the new offensive coordinator in Winnipeg. So it's interesting that he chose to leave for a different opportunity.
that's what makes me think that Burgoyne could be more involved in the offense here.
Yes, and I agree.
Also, from what I've been told, the football operations cap was in play here because Phillips had a contract for 2025. There could have been other members, you know, I guess to sort of calm JC down a little bit, of this coaching staff that were talked to that actually didn't make it into it because the football operations cap strikes again. So I think your point's well taken about Burgoyne, Hodge, that when you start to look at the specifics of it with him being the pass game coordinator, that perhaps that was to help get him out of Winnipeg. But it was surprising, you know, that he didn't stay there to potentially be the OC.
Yes. And for the record, Winnipeg's OC hunt doesn't really appear to have started yet. Like, I published an article on December 5th with 8 candidates to be the next offensive coordinator in Winnipeg. Marcus Howell has already taken a job in Calgary, so he's obviously not a candidate anymore. Paul Appelese, it very much seems, is focused solely on his media opportunities with TSN. So that limits the number to 6. Burgoyne was one of the 6. He's obviously no longer there. So I haven't talked to all 5 of these other people, but I have talked to more than half of those people. And as of late last week, none of them had been contacted by Winnipeg regarding an interview, which I thought was very interesting. Regardless, good luck to Burgoyne in BC. Good luck to Buck Pierce and his staff. I would probably agree with JC. On paper, I don't feel like the, I mean, it's not a bad staff, but I don't look at the staff as a big upgrade over 2024. But they might have me eating my words come June. We'll see.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Bo Levi Mitchell received a $54,000 roster bonus on January 1st, part of the $329,500 in hard money he's currently scheduled to earn in 2025. Mitchell indicated at the 111th Grey Cup in Vancouver that he wants to get rid of some of the, quote, prove it type stuff, close quote, in his contract, though no restructure has been announced. Dunk. How do you see this situation playing out between Mitchell and the Ticats?
You can understand it from both sides. And let's look at it from Mitchell's side, because he essentially wants to wipe out the playtime and bonus incentives in his contract to get himself over the $400,000 mark in hard money. But if you're the Ticats, you're saying, well, yeah, you set the single season franchise record with over 5,400 yards passing, but we did bench you. And you didn't come anywhere near the performance level required in 2023 to earn what you made that season. So we actually feel like in the CFL quarterback landscape that this is a pretty fair deal. So I think this could kind of go a couple ways here. It could just stay as it is with Ticats saying, hey, we're fine with this prove it type stuff in your contract. Go and earn it. You know, that could upset Mitchell, or it could be more motivation for him. The other scenario that I could see playing out, because there's another offseason roster bonus due, I believe it's February 1st, $50,000, that it would be to Mitchell and the team's benefit if the team did agree to a reworked deal where Mitchell gets a signing bonus, upfront money, whatever you want to call it, that he's taxed less on, and also that can save the team from a salary cap perspective. Now, that would mean that you're committing essentially to Bo Levi Mitchell being your starting quarterback when Scott Milanovic has been high on Taylor Powell in the past. But I think that that makes sense going into the 2025 season, considering the way that Mitchell played in 2024. So those are the couple, you know, likely scenarios that I could see playing out.
Bo has never been a quarterback who's asked for the sun, the moon, and the stars, right? Even when he was going to the Grey Cup, seemingly every year with Calgary, winning MOP awards. He was never the highest paid quarterback in the league. Or if he ever was, he certainly wasn't making as much as he probably could have had he truly wanted to max out his earnings. So I do expect that these two sides will come to an agreement on a new deal. I don't think Bo is asking for Nathan Rourke money or expects Nathan Rourke money. I think he just wants to be guaranteed more cash, which I personally understand 100%. Like, if Bo Levi Mitchell breaks his leg getting out of bed in the morning, or it suffers a torn ACL the first day of training camp, like, these are the protections that he needs and the protections that any player would covet, right, coming off of a MOP like season, which he did. So I've been led to believe from the Ticats perspective that they are prepared to do right by Bo, and I believe that Bo does want to be back in Hamilton very much. Like, I think that there is,
where else is he going to go to start?
Well, there's that, but I think that there is mutual interest here is the point. So I do expect this to get done. I'm actually a little bit surprised it's not already done, given that there was already an offseason roster bonus paid to him on the first. But then again, it's obvious as well that Ted Gavaya, the team's new GM, hasn't been on the job for long. I know during his introductory press conference, he said that the first call he would make was to Bo Levi Mitchell. So obviously they've been in communication. That being said, I think this is kind of an open shut case, or at least it should be, barring any very strange unforeseen circumstance. There is mutual interest, and just looking at it from a logistical perspective, there's no reason why this shouldn't get done. Bo gets a little bit more hard money. The Tiger Cats keep what is a very good 1-2 punch. And by the way, yes, Dunk, you mentioned Taylor Powell is under contract for 2025, but the amount of money he's making is paltry. Like, he signed an extension that is barely more than league minimum. He probably could have gotten way more money. So that doesn't put any pressure on the cap. So there's lots of money there, and I think that Bo is going to get a greater percentage of what he's due in 2025 as guaranteed cash.
Yeah, logically, this thing is going to get done, and Bo is going to get some sort of a pay bump here with a restructured contract. But the reason maybe that it hasn't happened yet is Bo doesn't have a ton of leverage, and there's not a ton of pressure on the Ticats to get anything done at this stage, because, as you mentioned, Dunk, not only is Mitchell under contract, so he physically can't go anywhere, there's not a lot of other spots that he could go, even if he wanted to. So really, it's down to a choice of either I pay for what they're, or play for what they're willing to pay me, or I retire and go into my future career, which for many expect Bo to go into broadcasting with TSN. I don't think he's ready to do that yet, so he has to play the Ticats game. And with their confidence in Taylor Powell as that backup, they can sort of string him along and move that number down, because they're not super scared about him up and retiring and moving on to his future career, because they know he's got more monetary benefit here, and they've got a guy in place already that they're comfortable with in the worst case scenario. So all the leverage is with the Ticats in this case. I think they will eventually give him a little bit more, but it's not going to be the sun, the moon, the stars.
Mekhi Polk became the first CFL player to sign an NFL contract this offseason, inking a deal with the Atlanta Falcons. The Saskatchewan Roughriders have released rookie left tackle Trevor Reed to pursue an NFL opportunity, which means he's going to sign with a team down south. How many more players do you think will join NFL teams?
As of the recording of this podcast, we do not know where Trevor Reed is signing. That being said, you have to have a contract offer to get your release from a team. So he will be signing, and obviously stay tuned to 3downnation.com for that information when it comes out. Might be out by the time you even listen to the show. To me, I think Jake Julian's going to sign. I mean, he did 6 workouts. This is, of course, the record-breaking punter for the Edmonton Elks. Ralph Hawley has also now done 6 workouts for NFL teams. Hawley tied for the league lead with 8 sacks this season as an interior guy, which is pretty special, winning a great cup with the Argonauts. So I think that those two will bring the number to 4. I don't think it's impossible that Nick Constantinou will do so as well for Hamilton, but the other one I would put my money on is Tyrell Ford, the athletic defensive back for the Winnipeg Blue Bombers. Ford has done 4 workouts thus far, and I think that he's got a good chance to sign. At least I've been led to believe. So that would bring the number to 5, which I think is a pretty typical number, at least since the CFL kind of went to this NFL window system that's now been in place for a few years. I'm not surprised that Polk signed. Polk, watching him on the field, you know, 6'3". I didn't realize how big he was till I met him in person at Grey Cup. To me, looks like an NFL receiver. I'm not sure he'll last long with the Falcons. We all thought that Austin Mack was going to get a real shot there. He did not last long there at all. But Polk, good for him taking this opportunity. Good for Trevor Reed getting this opportunity as a young guy still. The three that I would expect to follow are Julian Hawley and Ford. But you never know, right? It's not that long ago that Jake Ceresna got signed by the New York Giants after one NFL workout. Turns out one was all he needed to get that contract. Now, he didn't stick with the Giants. He ended up coming back to the CFL. But that would be my list right now for guys who I see signing down south.
Yeah, I think Ralph Hawley at this stage is essentially a slam dunk to sign. We did our full list of every CFL player that worked out with an NFL team.
You did it, JC. Take the credit.
It's a team effort. I put it together. You guys did a lot of the reporting initially of where these guys were going. But at that time, 2 days ago, he had 5 workouts, which was tied for second place among all players. He has since had 2 more workouts since the publishing of that article. That puts him at 7 above Jake Julian for the number one spot. I think that's a pretty good indication that he is going to have at least one opportunity, if not multiples. Jake Julian, I think, is a slam dunk NFLer. And the other guy who had 5 workouts like Mekhi Polk was Nick Constantino. And you mentioned you're a little bit on the fence with him, Hodge. I am as well, just based on his CFL numbers. But it should be noted with him coming out of, I believe it was Texas A&M, he was seeing a much higher regard by the NFL than a lot of the other punters that come up here as rookies through the global program. And I think a lot of people were surprised that he came up this early. They thought he would stick around in the NFL a little bit longer. So there may be some residual interest from his college career as well that's driving this. It would not shock me if he gets signed.
It should be noted on Trevor Reed, he worked out for the Indianapolis Colts, Minnesota Vikings, and Cincinnati Bengals. So you would imagine it's one of those three teams. But from our reporting, Mekhi Polk apparently didn't even work out for the Atlanta Falcons, or did the workout and then signed there the same day. So that was a bit of a different one. But I think the reference to Austin Mack is well taken, that it's great for these players to get opportunities, but the important part of all of this, and we've seen it with, you know, Canadians in the NFL draft or Canadians coming from U Sports, is where you go. And it's still the same regime in Atlanta that was there when Austin Mack was there. So hopefully something can shake out differently for Polk, guys, who, it should be noted, led the SEC in catches with 105 in his only season at Mississippi State, over 1,000 yards in that Southeastern Conference too, in that season. I think that would have helped his resume along with what he was able to do with the Argos. So you would think that could get him more of a legit shot, but Austin Mack, played at Ohio State. Didn't have 1,000 yards there in the season, but still had the pedigree of playing with the Buckeyes. That's sort of the, I don't want to say cautionary tale, but the reality of the situation, right? We saw it when we reported on almost every single thing that Nathan Rourke did through his NFL path. Even Matthew Betts last year, by all accounts, played really well with the Detroit Lions. And then all of a sudden they decided to move him to linebacker, a position he's never really been comfortable at or played for a long period of time. And he gets released. You know, I was thinking about this because the Detroit Lions, one top spot in the NFC, they've had all these defensive injuries. And how different could it be? You know, time, place, circumstance, I get it. If Betts even had signed to the practice roster, he probably would have played meaningful snaps for the Detroit Lions in 2024 and going into the playoffs in 2025. Alas, that obviously did not happen. But there was even a player, I think, that he was competing against in training camp that was released, you know, as the season went along. So these factors all matter in here. And I just really hope that some of the players that CFL fans have come to love at least get a little bit of respect from the NFL teams that they sign with.
JC, you wrote a column arguing against the idea of limiting punts in the CFL. Why was this your take?
Twofold. First of all, I resist the notion that punts are somehow less exciting than other plays in the sport. And I think the data backs this up. Your average punt return in the CFL is around 11 yards. Your average passing play is just under 9. Your average running play is just under or just over 5. So just from average yards perspective, you're gaining more traction with a punt return. But even from a big play perspective, it's basically the same for gains of over 30 yards between passing plays and punt returns, both at just over 4%. And it's way more big plays on punt returns of over 30 yards than there is running plays of just over 20 yards. So it's a more exciting play from that perspective. But I think my bigger concern is actually what a limitation on punts could do to offenses in terms of limiting them or making them be more conservative. Because I think a lot of people think, okay, you limit punts to 5 per game, that's going to create a bunch more third down gambles. That's going to make for more exciting situations, more exciting football. But teams don't want to have to gamble on third down and long when they don't have to, right? That's not a situation any football team wants to be in. So I think the unexpected result of limiting punts could be that offensive coordinators go, well, I can't take that big shot on first down because I don't want to be in second and long and then have a chance where I'm going to have to burn these punts early. I'm going to take more conservative play calls. I'm going to dink and dunk my way down the field. I'm going to use screens and run the ball a little bit more to put myself in second and short so that I have more manageable third downs. And it'll take away more big plays on offense. On the other side, if teams do burn their punts really early and their offense is super inefficient, which leads to the games that people point to when they say there's too much punting in the CFL, it's when the offenses suck, which sometimes happens. Well, if they can't get it done on third down, they're going to put themselves in bad position. The other team's going to score more points because they're going to be in prime field position. And it's going to create lopsided results that are more difficult for teams to come back from late in games, which is truly what makes the CFL so exciting. So I fear that this type of rule would have unintended consequences that would actually make the rest of the game less exciting than it currently is now.
Valid points, though I think it's worth a conversation. And we are seeing that all major pro sports leagues need to look at their game from a smart way and how it can be improved to attract new fans. That's essentially the name of the game. So to have this as a discussion point, I think can only be beneficial. And you made a lot of smart points there, JC, about how it could potentially affect the game. And obviously on the flip side of that, there are people saying, well, yeah, it'll create these situations where teams will go for it more on third downs and hopefully produce more touchdowns. I think that's ultimately what fans would like to see. And I know there are games in the NFL that are field goal fests or 6-3, and some of those have happened recently. I don't necessarily want to compare it to the NFL, but I think from a CFL perspective, you know, when was the last time that we had a quarterback throw for 40 touchdowns even, let alone 50 in single season? And this was a league that a lot of people flocked to, including Americans, to watch because of the wide open passing game, the gunslinger mentality. And we haven't seen those kind of passing touchdown numbers in years. Now, part of it might be the proliferation of the short yardage quarterback. You get it down to the goal line and you punch it in. So I understand that that's a potential takeaway. But I think we're missing that excitement, some of the gunslinging shootouts that we've seen in the past. I'm not saying they never happen, but the stats would show that they're more rare, and it's more sexy to promote a quarterback who's thrown for 40 or 50 touchdowns. And I know Bo Levi Mitchell threw for 5,000 yards, so he's kind of getting close there. But I think the touchdowns are a key aspect of all of this that the CFL is trying to get. You know, I haven't really liked some of the field position tweaks that they've made because I feel like they're tilting the field in favor of the offense so much that it makes me think that I would just like to see more aggressiveness. But then you got to think of all the other layers kind of that JC touched on, but that there's job security and the rest there that come into the play for the coaches and the players too.
I thought that your second point, JC, was solid. Yes, the fear, the unintended consequence could be that offenses get more conservative. That being said, I think there's also an argument to be made the other way, where if you're an offensive coordinator, you're out of punts and it's second and 10, well, why not have it dialed up 40 yards down the field? And it's like, well, if it gets picked off, then it's an arm punt and it's not a problem. And if we draw PI, it's a big play, first down. If we catch it, it's a big play, it's a first down. Like, the only really bad thing that can happen is an incompletion. I thought your first point is moot and insane, because comparing a punt to, you know, a 5-yard run on first down, that is apples and oranges. On third down, only two things can happen. Either you gamble, which is extremely exciting, or you punt. Which, yes, punting is a lot more exciting in the CFL than it is in the NFL because of what I would deem far superior special teams rules in the CFL. That being said, no, I'm sorry, nobody has ever watched a punt and thought, oh, thank goodness they didn't gamble. This is much more exciting and interesting. I would venture to say even special teams coordinators feel that way. Like, no, you cannot compare an average, banal offensive play to a punt and say, see, they're even. No, it is either a punt or it is a gamble. And gambling, aside from maybe an onside kick, which is tremendously exciting, might be the most exciting thing that can happen in any football game. Obviously, down south, it would be a fourth down gamble. Gambling on third down down south is nothing special. They just call that third down. So to me, I think your second point is well taken. To me, the magic number, by the way, is not 5. I think it's probably 6. The average game in the CFL last year had about 11.5 punts. So I think you give both teams 6. And, you know, at that rate, it probably doesn't even come in to a lot of games. But, you know, if you punt 4 times in the first half, all of a sudden it's like, okay, you know, maybe in the third quarter, you know, if we're 3rd and 2 at our opponent's 45-yard line, maybe before we were trying a 52-yard field goal, or maybe, you know, in other circumstances, we try to punt out at the 5-yard line, maybe now we go for it. And that is, I think, a lot more exciting than the alternative where you're getting field goals or you're getting teams punting and, you know, passing on these 55 or 52-yard field goals that they could otherwise try. So I do like this idea overall, though I'd want to see it tested before it came into regular season play.
I still think punts are very exciting plays, and I love them.
Well, you're the only one who feels that way.
But I do want to touch...
There's got to be some others.
I got to touch a little bit on the point that Dunk made, which I think is well taken in terms of the game being somewhat less wide open than it once was. And I think a lot of people bring this up nostalgically when talking about 80s and 90s CFL in terms of those big passing numbers and those touchdowns and how that game was. I think it's a lot of people fell in love with the game when it was like that. I don't think that punting would change that. I think the reason why we don't see those numbers is twofold. First of all, and it's the same thing in the NFL right now with the different types of zone defenses that people are seeing, it's harder to pass than it's ever been before. And they've talked about that south of the border, as well as we see the running game sort of have a resurgence because teams are trying to exploit that. I think a similar thing is happening in the CFL. But also, when guys were throwing for 40 and 50 touchdowns a season regularly, they were also throwing for 20 or 25 interceptions, right? There was far greater freedom for guys to have turnovers at the quarterback position. We saw it this year with Bo Levi Mitchell. He was putting up great numbers all season, but he was benched in the middle of the year, almost taken off the field because he had 12 interceptions to go along with, I think it was 18 touchdowns at that point. So even though he had huge yardage numbers and was leading the league, there was not the appetite to absorb that risk anymore in the modern game. I think that mindset has to shift. If you want to see those big numbers, you have to be willing to take on some of the interceptions as well and some of those turnovers. Right now, teams collectively on both sides of the border have decided that that's not the type of quarterback play that they want to see anymore. They want to see high efficiency, and it becomes more difficult to score a whole bunch when you're playing that type of game.
I understand that it could potentially be harder to pass the ball in this day and age, but quarterbacks are also more precise as well. There's training, all the rest to go along with it. And you do see guys, you know, putting up gaudy stats like Joe Burrow, particularly in the NFL this season. I know the Bengals defense wasn't great, but you can put up a lot of yards and passing touchdowns without turning the football over a bunch. And I do think it goes back to a word that I believe both of you have used. And that's, you know, just, I don't even know how to say this fairly, but it's not about not being aggressive, but just being conservative because you're trying to protect yourself and your job. I don't think that's what coaches are thinking in games, but I think that's kind of where we've gotten to is people have made a big deal about the turnover differential. But like in some of the biggest games that we've seen, like I think of the West Final, what was it, 2 or 3 years ago, right? Like the Bombers, or no, the Riders won the turnover battle by a bunch, but didn't win the football game. That could be an indicator, but football is also an inexact science. It's not Moneyball here where we're talking about baseball and always a pitcher pitching from 60 feet, 6 inches. And the majority of the stadiums are, you know, somewhat the same. Yes, they're a little bit different, but it's different. So when we talk about these things, sometimes you can use the data, sometimes you can't. Some people like to use the data. Some people laugh at JC always using the data when he talks about stuff like this. So I think that's part of why it's an intriguing debate. I just think that there is a way for more touchdowns and passing touchdowns at that to happen in this day and age because the quarterbacks have improved too, not just the defenses, with all due respect to defensive backs around the world.
Longtime CFL coach Chris Jones has landed a new job. As Dunk, you reported, he has joined the University of North Carolina Tar Heels as a defensive assistant under legendary former NFL head coach Bill Belichick. How did this move come about, and what does it mean for Jones's future?
The connection with the Tar Heels, it's simple. Freddie Kitchens, he was the head coach with the Cleveland Browns in 2019, who brought Jones on as a senior, I think it was defensive analyst that season. And Kitchens is the offensive coordinator with the Tar Heels, and based on credible reports, seems like Bill Belichick is going to keep him on his staff. Belichick's complete staff hasn't been officially announced, but Jones is already working. So that's the connection there. And then to go back even further, Jones was a graduate assistant coach at the University of Alabama, I think it was in 1997, while Kitchens was a quarterback with the Crimson Tide. So that's how far back those two go. And then obviously you have Kitchens under Belichick and his new staff there. And that's where Jones gets in. He's already working, from what I've been told, with the Tar Heels, doing some recruiting as well. And I think it helps Jones's future in the long run. To be tied to Bill Belichick is going to help you, you know, especially if the Tar Heels have success in 2025. If Belichick goes back to the NFL, there's credible reports out there about teams asking Belichick to rethink his move to UNC. So if even if Belichick were to move on, you would think Jones would be in a good position just to be tied to Bill Belichick. There was some chatter about this that I had heard behind the scenes, but you know, to be honest, it was hard to believe because you're thinking this is Bill Belichick, you know, one of the greatest coaches of all time. And he's going to hire Chris Jones, like with all due respect, but then you start to think about the connections. And that's ultimately what a lot of pro football is about, is people might not like the politics, the connections help. And that's how Chris Jones has gotten to UNC.
Well, I mean, it's the same way Mark Trestman, right, got in with the Chargers after not coaching for a number of years. It's, well, him and Jim Harbaugh are very long tenured friends and colleagues dating all the way back to their days together with the then Oakland Raiders, right? I mean, these connections run very deep. I remember sitting on this very show after Chris Jones was fired in July, and we were talking about, well, is he ever going to get back into the CFL? And I'm like, yeah, probably, because he knows a lot of people. And lo and behold, the next month, I think it was, he was hired as the defensive coordinator in Hamilton because him and Scott Milanovich go way back. So I'm not really surprised by this. Chris Jones has been coaching for 30 years at this point. He is now in his late 50s. I would anticipate that he is going to try to coach for the next 20 years. And this is just the latest stop for him. The most interesting thing about this story to me is, what is Bill Belichick going to do, right? There's six NFL openings right now. He tried desperately to get one of those jobs last year, was not successful. I think only garnered one interview in Atlanta before ultimately being passed over for that job. I believe Raheem Morris got that job. I can't remember who the head coach was. Right. Raheem Morris. So we'll see what happens with Bill Belichick.
If I'm Belichick, just on that note real quick, Hodge, I'm staying at UNC, committing to that for 2025. You know, ideally doing well, turning the program around and winning. The Tar Heels were 6-7 in 2024, and creating even more leverage for yourself. If you already have NFL teams asking for you to reconsider your move to UNC, how much more leverage could you have if you prove yourself at the college level with a winning season? And we all know there's so much money flying around in the NCAA with the NIL and the rest these days. Now, why wouldn't you stay there for 1 year? I mean, he brought out his dad's, what was it, sweatshirt that he had at his press conference from way back in the day. Like, that's a connection to UNC for Belichick. So, you know, if I'm him, I'm staying at UNC, turning the program around, and you could be courted by big-time NCAA programs and NFL teams after one good season.
I don't disagree with any of that. The only thing I will point out is the man is 72 years old. He's made a bajillion dollars already, and he's apparently making $10 million in salary at UNC. So, like, at some point, like, don't you just want to sit on a beach?
That's like boring, bro.
But the guy has more money than God at this point. Like,
that's
like,
what I'm saying, but what else
understand.
Is he going to go and do? He loves football.
He does.
And at some point, you know, you do the media thing a little bit. I'm sure he could have sat around on the beach in 2024 in between media stuff. Like, you get bored, man. And when you shut down, your body shuts down too.
I suppose. It's going to shut down regardless at some point. That's how human bodies work. And he's going to be 73 next year.
Like, Brian Johnson. Have you guys seen this cat?
I don't even know who Brian Johnson is.
Google Brian Johnson don't die.
Wasn't Brian Johnson the lead singer of AC/DC and did die?
This is a different Brian Johnson.
Oh, no, Brian Johnson is the alive lead singer of AC/DC. My apologies. He is the first
don't
person.
Don't put him in the grave yet.
He's 77. He's alive. Sorry, the first singer in AC/DC died, and then Brian Johnson came in.
There you go.
Bon Scott,
the Brian Johnson
the
I'm talking
away.
About, he wants to decrease his age number. He's going on this crazy experiment. He's got a bunch of money, so he can do it.
Decrease his age number?
Number. There's a term for it that I'm still trying to understand. Like, he doesn't want to age 1 year in 1 year. He's got it down to like 0.69 or 67 or 66 or something.
I think Bill
Belichick trying to slow down the aging process.
I think Bill Belichick just did that by getting a 24-year-old girlfriend. Isn't that
how
most
men
do it?
Yeah.
That's possible.
Getting back on the topic of Chris Jones, I actually think this is kind of a good fit for Jones, and that might be a controversial take, but he's going there. I mean, great situation under Bill Belichick, an absolute icon and legend in the sport of football that can position you for future jobs, either in college or the NFL. But also, what are the two things that Chris Jones has become known for in the CFL? Great recruiter, and sometimes bending the rules, going outside of things, outside of the structure. Well, what's important when you're a defensive assistant in college? Your ability to recruit. I think he's going to do a great job of that, working with their personnel department, and exploiting that transfer portal. But then there's no rules in college anymore, right? It's the wild, wild west out there. Who could be better suited to exploit that than Chris Jones? I think this is going to be his favorite job ever.
You make a good point. There are literally,
not wrong,
it seems like, no rules, an endless amount of money in college football right now. So where else would you want to be if you're Chris Jones? Hodge, did you figure out who Brian Johnson is yet?
I'll have to look it up later.
Okay. Moving on. Three Down Nation unveiled its ranking of all 70, count them, primary logos in CFL history over the holidays. The voting was conducted by 11 contributors plus CFL podcaster Greg McCullough, who is also a professional graphic designer. He's done some really cool stuff that he puts on X or Twitter, whatever we're calling it. With at least one person there was representing each CFL market. What did you guys make from these rankings overall?
This was kind of my idea. I will take credit for it in that regard.
You should.
And I'm the, and actually, and I will also say this, there have been times in the past where we've done rankings where it's just one ballot and everybody can see how everybody else voted. I did not do that with this ballot because I think there are times where, you know, if five people have already given a logo a really high rating, you might be more likely to give it a high rating too. Or if five people have already voted and they've given something a poor ranking, you're maybe more likely to give it a poor ranking. So everybody got a blank ballot. They submitted it to me and then I used those ballots to create a mega ballot, if you will, where everyone's scores were there. So nobody was influenced based off anybody else's grades. And I graded them before I passed out the ballot. So I was not, in my grading, thwarted by anybody else or influenced by anybody else. So it was interesting to see some logos garner very high grades from some people, very low grades from other people. I also just loved seeing some of these vintage logos that I've never seen before. Like, I had no idea that for a brief time, the Winnipeg Blue Bombers had the Golden Boy, which sits atop the Manitoba legislature, as their logo. It's a terrible logo, though. It did, in researching that a little bit, lead to finding some very cool photos of what was then known as Osborne Stadium, which is now just kind of an open green space in front of the legislature. That's a super cool backdrop with like the river and the lead. Anyways, I had no idea that the Rough Riders once had, and I'm talking about the Ottawa Rough Riders, by the way, a logo that featured a cowboy breaking in a horse, because I've always been led to believe that Saskatchewan was called the Rough Riders because they were named after ranch hands who would break horses. But Ottawa, that was not the case. They were named after an infantry in the Spanish-American War. So, like, some of these logos just make no sense, is the point I'm trying to make. That being said, the thing that stood out most to me was how the modern logos of the CFL fared extremely well. Right? Like when you think about nostalgia and you think about tradition, like, you'd almost think that the new logos are at a disadvantage compared to the logos that so many of us grew up with or so many of us have known for so long. But in reality, if you look at the top 15 that we came in with, like the Edmonton Elks logo finished second. Toronto's current logo is right up there. So many, like the Riders' current logo is right up there. Hamilton's current logo is right up there. Ottawa's current logo is right up there. Montreal's current logo is right up there. So I was really surprised to see how many logos that are not even 10 years old are right at the top, because there's no, like, I guess you could argue there's recency bias, but I'd almost argue that for something like this, nostalgia bias would be stronger, and that doesn't appear to be the case. So clearly the CFL's logos have generally improved over time. When you look at how many very, very vintage ones were at the bottom and how many modern ones were close to the top.
I thought this was an incredibly fun process, and kudos to you, Hodge, for pulling it off. I know it was a lot of work to compile all this and make sure we had all the logos even in picture form. I think there was two major mistakes on this ranking, though, and I will go to my grave feeling this. First of all, the BC Lions vintage logo of the mountain lion with his paw on a football, I think landed in the 40s in our ranking. That's an iconic logo. I don't care who you are. That's a top 10 vintage logo in any sport. For me personally, I don't know how it didn't rank higher. But I do take issue also with our first overall logo, which is the old school CFL logo with the helmet and the maple leaf inside. I don't think that's a bad logo by any stretch of the imagination, but number one overall, I think that's where the nostalgia crept in, because a lot of our contributors were born in the era or grew up watching the CFL in the era when that was the logo. I do not have the same connection to it as clearly a lot of other people did. And I don't even think it's the best iteration of the CFL logo. I think that was absolutely egregious that that was number one overall.
The fact that the Edmonton Elks current, I guess, not so current logo anymore, right? Because they're going to the double E
now
word
mark,
whatever. But anyways,
logo.
The Elks secondary logo ranks second. Like, WTF, guys. I don't get it.
Oh, I love that
logo. And I admittedly didn't do these rankings because I struggle with rankings, as John and JC well know. But, like, I like the logo, but I'm just surprised from a nostalgia standpoint that it ranks number two. And, like, come on. The Alouettes logo fifth? It's some writing with, like, a kid's drawing of a bird in the middle. Like, what are we talking about? What about the Anthony Calvillo years where he had this mean-looking bird
that logo
on a logo?
Why does the bird have teeth?
Birds don't have teeth. The Calvillo era logo.
But it's a mean bird. Who
cares?
It's better than this thing.
No, the current logo is way better.
You
I think you're the
crazy.
Only one who. I think you're the only one who feels like that.
No,
by the way,
be some people from Montreal.
I
for
will,
sure.
I will tip some stuff here. So the Alouettes' current logo, from all of our voters, garnered only one score less than a six, and that was from Troy Durrell, who gave it a three. So I'm outing you, Troy.
Oh, you're naming
apologies.
Names here.
I'll name names. Santino Filoso and Brendan McGuire both gave it a 10 out of 10. So if you take issue with their high score, for the record, I gave it a 7. I think it's good. I don't think it's amazing. JC gave it an 8, and you gave it nothing because you, again, didn't complete your ballot, which I requested you do multiple times. So it's a little bit rich that you're sitting here ragging on these. I will say this. For the Elks, one person gave it a 10 out of 10. That was Santino Filoso, gave it a 10 out of 10. Nobody gave it less than a 7. So that is the biggest reason why the Elks were so high, is it didn't have any low scores, right? The logo that finished at the very top, the old school helmet logo for the CFL, garnered 2 5s. Ben Grant and Ryan Ballantyne gave it a 5, but it also received multiple 10s. Santino gave it a 10. Santino's given everything 10s. Santino gave it a 10. Brendan McGuire gave it a 10. I gave it a 10. Jeez. And JC Abbott gave it a 10 after sitting here saying that he didn't think it was
Shouldn't
that
have been
good.
Number one, though. Lions vintage.
You gave it a 10.
Bro, you can't just be giving out 10s. Come
for the
on,
record,
these people, Santino Filoso. What
70,
are you doing?
70 logos. There's got to be a few 10s.
Yeah, you got to have a few 10s.
I know, but you can't just be giving them out willy-nilly. Like, what are we talking about? I get, okay, the Elks logo, from a pure logo standpoint, is legit. It just hasn't been around long enough. I can't fathom how the CFL logo with the football and the maple leaf was not number one. Like, the radically Canadian era was not number one on this list. What are you guys smoking? Must be that BC Kush. And yes, I did not vote. But, like, the Argonaut logo, where it looks like, you know, my niece stitched the football to what appears to be a boat, came in at 8.
Like, the boat logo's great. What are you talking about?
It looks like, honestly, something that my nephew could draw, who's 8 years old.
Wow.
Like, and then the Rough Riders logo is ranked behind it. Like, you guys are crazy. Honestly, there's going to be debate here in Hodge, rightfully so. You should crown my ass for not putting my ballot in, but I just struggle with this stuff so much. And then I look at it and I go, like, you guys are crazy. I don't know. Maybe I should have had a hand in the final thing at some stage. So it's
no, you shouldn't have, because your ballot was your say, and you didn't want your say. I didn't take any liberties with the final rankings. I just did my ballot. For the record, Santino gave 6 10s. So out of 70 logos. But that's out of 70 logos. So I don't think that's a crazy amount of 10s.
What was the lowest ranking for any logo? Like, could you rank a logo negatively? Could it have negative
it was
points?
No, the lowest was 1. And for the record, the lowest ranked logo of any logo, which was Winnipeg's logo from 1959 to 1965, garnered 2 4s. That was the highest score. It also garnered 1 3. It garnered 5 2s. I was one of those 2s. And it garnered 4 1s. 4 1s. So a ton of 1s and 2s. It garnered an average score, by the way, of 2.08. That was the lowest. The logo that finished in first, which was the CFL's logo, the helmet logo, garnered an average score of 8.08. So the scores essentially fell between 2 and 8. I will also say I was surprised at the amount of pushback from people who said that giving the CFL logo the number one spot was a cop-out. Like, I guess they were expecting us to take this, like, big... It's like, but it is a CFL logo? Like, why is the league getting it? Like, it's not CFL team logos. It's just CFL. So a bunch of people seem very upset about that. I didn't really understand that. If you're looking for the best team logo, I guess it's the Elks because that finished 2. But regardless, this was really fun. We did not include teams that have never played. There were some people I saw who were upset about the Schooners being included. The Miami Manatees were also not included. And the reason for that was if you really want to go down the rabbit hole of like proposed CFL teams, then that's opening a big old can of worms. I just wanted teams that actually played. The American logos, I thought, fared pretty well. Like the Birmingham Barracudas not being a bottom 10 logo surprised me. I gave it a 3, but multiple people gave it an 8, which I thought was crazy. Greg, the professional graphic designer, gave it a 7, which I thought, again, I didn't occur to me that people thought that that would be a good logo, but that is why we cast a wide net with this project. And that is why we try to, I think sometimes we just assume that people agree with us when, you know, they might not. So that's why I wanted to do this project. I was happy with how it turned out. Last offseason, we ranked the U Sports logos. We've now ranked the CFL logos. And
What's next?
CJFL, maybe? I don't know.
Ooh.
We'll figure something out.
There's some not so great logos.
We need the people to rank the logos.
Asking members of the public who are almost inevitably going to be biased towards one particular team to rank 70 logos is quite an undertaking. But if we want to open it up to the pub, maybe we'll do this exact project again next year. We'll open it up to the public. I don't think it's a bad idea. But 70 logos is a lot, man. That's a lot.
It is.
Now time for Hodge's Heritage Moment. On this day in 2024, that's right, we're going back 1 year, the Winnipeg Blue Bombers promoted Jordan Younger to defensive coordinator and hired Mike Miller as their special teams coordinator. Younger had spent the previous 6 seasons as Winnipeg's defensive backs coach and had a strong first year with his unit finishing first in points allowed, first in yards allowed, and fifth in takeaways. The results from Miller's unit were a little more mixed as Winnipeg finished 6th in net punting, tied for 7th in punt return average, 5th in kickoff average, and 8th in kickoff return average. Boys, we talked a little bit about Winnipeg's OC situation. When are they going to find somebody?
It better be soon. Like, you need to have some idea of what your plan is before you go into free agency.
Mike O'Shea doesn't care. He's on a trip with the Toronto Maple Leafs. He takes his time. He does it on his schedule.
But I'll take people behind the curtain here a little bit, by the way. So about a year ago, Scott Billick, local Winnipeg reporter, has since moved to a news job with the Winnipeg Free Press. But at the time, was in the sports department with the Winnipeg Sun, predominantly covering the Winnipeg Jets. And it was last offseason, I believe it was. I don't remember the occasion. But the Jets were in the middle of their season, and someone was running late. So I was in the press room when Scott was like OSHA just basically pulled him aside and was just hammering him with questions about the Jets and the NHL. And they talked for like 10 minutes, and then the press conference got started. We did our thing. And then after the press conference, OSHA, who hates doing media, by the way, will fully admit that, and is like a respectful person, but isn't overly media friendly, again, chatted with Scott for like 10 minutes about just hockey, like just the Jets. Like, OSHA loves hockey. And I said to Scott, I'm like, can you please, Well, I was like, can you please come to, I mean, he's from North Bay, Ontario, so it checks out. But I said to Scott, I'm like, can you please come to all CFL avails with Oj, because he is in such a better mood when you're here. And he kind of laughs. But anyways, yeah, O'Shea loves hockey.
Yeah, I was looking
find out
the
connection with the Leafs.
Well, I was looking
through
the...
I have an idea. I could speculate.
You should. That is the journalistically responsible thing to do, always.
Fine, I'll do it. So, former University of Guelph Griffin football player Dan Noble is very well respected in the strength and conditioning space, I guess we'll call it, and he trains Mitch Marner. So, I was wondering if there was a connection there, you know, because Mike O'Shea holds his time with the Griffins very near and dear to his heart. So, that's just... some speculation, though. I don't know if that's actually the connection.
I wondered if it was because of Ryan Reeves, who, of course, is the son of Willard Reeves, the legendary Bombers running back, and brother of Jordan Reeves, who played in the CFL. Didn't spend a ton of time under Mike O'Shea, but his first training camp, his first CFL opportunity, was under O'Shea in Winnipeg. Very brief stint before he was cut, but there's a little bit of a connection there, but nothing official has come out.
That's possible. The other thing that comes to mind for me with Marner is Noble trained Zach Kolaris. Did I say it right, Hodge?
Kolaris.
So they trained together. So, you know, I don't necessarily know if they spent any time together, like Marner, Kolaris. And O'Shea. But I was kind of thinking, well, there you're kind of having a bunch of different touch points. So it could be the case. Let's go to the 3-minute drill.
The middle syllable in Zach's name is just the letter R, Kolaris. If you say the R in the middle, then you got it.
Kolaris.
Yeah, that was good. Nice job.
Zach Kolaris.
There you go.
Anyways, former NFL and CFL receiver Tavon Smith has officially retired from professional football. How will you remember his career?
Ultimately, I hate to say it, it's just disappointing, right? Like he came in with tremendous collegiate credibility, got signed by the Indianapolis Colts, and I remember thinking, like, if this guy ever comes up to the CFL, which took a few years, he could be a top five receiver regardless of passport. And that, unfortunately, I don't know if it's due to injuries or whatnot, just never happened. So unfortunately, Tavon Smith never hit like I was hoping he would. JP Metris Trophy winner Gio Vaccaro is transferring from the University of Manitoba to Purdue University for his final year of collegiate eligibility. Could that help him get NFL interest?
It certainly could. It's a bit of a double-edged sword, because if he goes there and he isn't able to get on the field, then he may actually get less NFL interest than he would have as a highly touted potential two-time JP Metris Trophy winner like we saw with Theo Bettergett. But if he goes there with the Boilermakers, performs, becomes a starter, I think that's really going to help him in the eyes of NFL scouts, and he certainly has that ability. Chase Brown missed out on an opportunity to hit 1,000 rushing yards after he was ruled out for Cincinnati's last game due to injury. Will the Canadian running back ever have a 1,000-yard NFL season?
Yes, I believe he's endeared himself to Joe Burrow and Zach Taylor. And the most important part, he's still on his rookie contract. The Bengals have some big-time players to pay, including T. Higgins, if they want to keep him in Cincinnati, so I can see Brown continuing to be the starter with the Bengals. The Blue Bombers have re-signed veteran Canadian offensive lineman Patty Neufeld. Was that the right move, though, Hodge?
I think it was. I think that after he took a month off to actually get his knee back to 100%, Neufeld was a very solid player for them at guard, though he did admit that he's not at 100% of the game he used to be at. The other thing that I think is really interesting here, Liam Dobson, who was a first-year starter, but his rookie contract is coming to an end. I wonder if the Bombers fear they are going to lose him as a free agent, which would be why potentially they've brought back Neufeld. Remains to be seen. Top-ranked 2025 CFL draft offensive line prospect Eric Schoen has chosen to retire from football instead of pursuing a professional career. How big of a blow is that to the draft list?
It's not that big of a blow overall. I think Schoen was a very solid prospect, but it was a bit of a farce that he was ranked number 4 overall in the Summer Scouting Bureau rankings. Those are never accurate. And then, of course, he transferred to Duke and barely played this last year. He still had CFL potential, but I don't know if he would have ended up being a top 20 prospect when all was said and done. And I think he's going to have much higher earning potential working in the business world. Canadian QB Curtis Rourke had a torn ACL for the entire 2024 season with the Indiana Hoosiers and is having surgery to fix it. What does this mean for his NFL draft stock?
You know, could hurt it if he's going to miss a lot of his rookie season, but then there are NFL teams who fall in love with prospects, and I've talked to people south of the border that believe that Rourke has special arm talent. So if there is a team that hasn't already fallen in love with him but does so through the draft process, and I expect him to do well in interviews and all the things that, you know, he can actually physically do, then I think it will hurt his draft stock, but potentially not as much as people would think, especially, JC, as you well know, with this draft class at the quarterback position not being a particularly high-end one. G-Roy Simon is reportedly being hired as the general manager for the University of Maryland, his alma mater, after reports initially surfaced that he would be serving the same role at Sacramento State. What's going on?
Well, mixed reports. That's what's going on. And I've been led to believe nothing is currently official as of the recording of this show, but will soon become official. So I do expect Simon to land with his alma mater. The ink, however, is not yet on the contract, as far as I am aware. JC, your article about Maven Moore was our most read piece in 2024, topping a list that also included Nathan Rourke's contract details, the sideline incident in Ottawa, McLeod Bethel-Thompson getting fined, and Kadeem Carey calling out Calgary. How does it feel to earn the number one spot? You got the belt!
Well, I don't care personally that I was the writer of the number one article, but I will say this. I love all the work we do at Three Down Nation, but sometimes when we get to these year-end lists, it's luck of the draw, and there's articles on there. You go, oh, that wasn't really our best of the year. I don't know why that's on there. I think this year, the entire list was reflective of some of the absolute best work that we did as journalists this season, and I think having that particular article about Marr at the number one spot, I'm incredibly proud and privileged that we were able to tell that story, and it was deserving of that place on the list. The Regina Thunder have added former Riders receiver Chris Getzlaf to their coaching staff. Is that a smart move?
I think it is. This is the guy that cut his teeth in junior football before going to the University of Regina Rams and then starting in the CFL for the most part with the Saskatchewan Roughriders. So to add a guy like that who sees the game from a unique perspective can only help the Thunder. The BC Lions have signed 39-year-old kicker Sean White to a one-year contract extension for the 2025 season. Will he become one of the CFL's top 10 scorers after this year is done?
I think he will. He's very close to Terry Baker, the longtime Montreal Alouette, 410th on the list. The question is, how high can he go? Yeah, he's 39, but I mean, heck, Bob Cameron played till he was 48. Does Sean White have another 10 years in him? I wouldn't rule it out.
10 years, bro.
I mean, he's a super accurate kicker who doesn't rely on power. Homeboy could play till he's 75. He should be talking to this Chris, whatever the heck his name is.
Ryan aging. Johnson guy.
He's aging at whatever it is, 60% of a year. I don't know. BC released veteran defensive end Pete Robertson after he recorded only 2 sacks last season. Do you see him getting signed anywhere?
I think he'll probably get another CFL look somewhere, not as a highly paid or highly touted prospect, but he's a good functional CFL player. I still think he brings value as a run defender. There's probably a spot for him on somebody's roster. Mike O'Shea participated in the Toronto Maple Leafs' recent mentorship trip. How cool is that?
It's cool, man. Maybe Mike O'Shea is cooler than we think. Perhaps he's like Bill Belichick behind the scenes, a guy that can joke around and have a good time, as Hodge kind of pulled back the curtain on. We'll have to dig into that. Maybe he's more willing to talk hockey than football because he doesn't want to give away all his trade secrets. The Minnesota Vikings have promoted Daniel Jones and, in a subsequent move, waived Canadian-American quarterback Brett Rypien. Hodge, do you ever think that we'll see him play in the Canadian Football League?
I mean, he's made $5 million in the NFL. That being said, I mean, this run might have come to an end now. He did not actually see the field this year. Last year, he bounced between three different teams. The only issue is, I don't believe he officially has his CFL passport. And obviously, if he's coming up to the Canadian Football League, he would want that national status. So there's some paperwork that needs to be done.
What's a CFL passport?
A Canadian passport, if I misspoke. He wants that status in the CFL. So there's paperwork that needs to be done. I'm also not really clear, because he's never gone through the CFL draft. Would he just be grandfathered in as a free agent, or would he have to actually go through the CFL draft as someone who's played professionally for a bunch of years? Like, this was a big issue in TJ Jones, the Winnipeg native, mm-hmm. who played receiver for the Detroit Lions, tried to come up here. He was deemed a free agent. Now, I don't know if that would be the same with Rippon, but this is kind of a special circumstance, right? I don't know if JC, if you have any insight to that, or if the CFL will just make this up as they go along.
That's what they tend to do. I would hope that the CFL would say, if Brett Rippon wants to come and play in our league, as long as you have Canadian citizenship, you can be a free agent. Because is Rippon going to come up here, go through the draft process, play for $80,000, let's call it, on a 2 or 3 year deal?
He wouldn't have to do that, because the current rule is that every year you spend in the NFL eliminates one off your rookie deal. So presumably that would still apply to Rippon. Now, I don't think he would be grandfathered in like TJ Jones, because TJ Jones was drafted prior to the CFL changing the national rules. Like, it was the same situation with the rest of the Westermans, or Jamal Westerman specifically. Like, they were grandfathered in because they were prior to the change of the national definition. But the CFL makes stuff up all the time. So I'm sure if Brett Rippon gave the league office a call, there would be some agreement to be made.
Do you think there would be a bidding war for Brett Rippon? If he came up here, let's say, and he was a free agent.
Probably, but not like a high-end bidding war. Like,
well, let's remember PJ Walker, who did not have the opportunity to negotiate with really any other teams because he was on the NAG list for Calgary, is getting six figures in hard money as essentially a CFL rookie in 2025. Yeah, there was
Walker situation was a bit different, though.
Yeah, because again, he didn't have. So what I'm saying is, even without the leverage of free agency, he was able to get six figures in hard money for 2025.
No, but I'm saying that, like, PJ Walker, from what I understood, could have gone to the Toronto Argonauts, but looked at the situation and said, well, you have Chad Kelly.
Yes.
Right? So then that was sort of the impetus for the deal.
For the trade that happened.
What I'm getting at. Yeah.
But what I'm saying is, if Brett Rippon was a true free agent, like, PJ Walker got six figures with no leverage. So if he got that with no leverage, then all of a sudden Brett Rippon, who's got a Canadian passport and lots of leverage, presumably, as a free agent, yes, I think there would be a bidding war. Would he get paid Nathan Rourke money? No. It's hard to bring a rookie onto your team who's making big money. That's a locker room issue. But Brett Rippon, as an NFL tenured quarterback who has a Canadian passport, yes, I think a team would be more than happy to spend legit money on him. What does legit money mean? I don't think he's getting $500K, but I'd venture to guess he would get, you know, maybe it's like Drew Brown money. Maybe it's that kind of like second contract money that a lot of guys get when they're not necessarily proven as a starter. But then again, I'm not an agent. I just play one on TV. On that note, we thank you as always for listening to the Three Down Nation podcast.
You're on TV, Hodge?
This is YouTube, and YouTube is TV now. So I'll say TV, yes. My nephew watches us on YouTube, and he thinks that I'm like the coolest person ever as a result. Because if you're under the age of 12.
And then he was like, but you don't have that many subscribers. So we need to get that subscriber count up.
I don't know if we'll ever catch Mr. Beast, but we'll try. We'll see you next Wednesday for our next episode.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.